so that this way, in the event that there's a ground fault in the house that's flowing through the pipe to earth, if the meter is pulled or the valve is pulled, there is no potential across it. But the actual, you're not allowed to rely on that for grounding the service. The service has to be grounded on the ground side of the valve where it first comes in through the wall. KD2, HUT, back to net.
Nice wires.
Okay, KC2QIQ is the next person I heard. Go right ahead, Glenn. Yeah, I didn't catch the call sign of the other person, but just before me, but he's absolutely correct, Dick, that troll has to be connected to ground at the entry point of the house. That's exactly right where the, you want to have your lightning protection at every entry level. And, of course, any other utility services like your cold water service, your waste water service, all should be ground bonded back to that neutral lightning ground bonding connection right where the power enters the house so that the neutral is connected. And where does the danger come in? In other words, if a wire gets broken, that you can have extremely high potentials coming into your house, it's when the neutral bond breaks. And that's because if you lose the neutral bond and your house is just sitting at the earth potential earth level and you lose the neutral, now everything would float up. And that's really where the problem comes in that you're describing before. But really, that's why neutral and ground must be connected. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me ask an extreme question on this one, Glenn. Assume now that many of us amateurs have from time to time been discussing the great big copper plate where each one of our coaxial cables enters the house, they all get grounded to that copper plate, and that copper plate goes to a local grounding rod, and indoor extra wiring goes into the neutral of the house, the way some people wire it. If I was doing a double John, a belt and suspenders, really correct job, where I don't want to have potential differences between grounds. I want to have a single point of grounding. If I really carried that through to the extreme, I would take all the coax cables from my tower and don't bring them into the nearest place in the house where the ham shack is. I'd bring all of those cables over to the main service entrance where the 240 volt line comes into the house. I would bring all the coax cables to that point where there should be a local grounding rod there, if I'm doing it by modern standards, and then my cables get grounded there, and then after they enter the house, I then, inside the house, bring those cables all the way back to the shack. I've now extended my coax cables a much longer length, but now I have a truly common point grounding for both lightning grounding and whatever. I know that's to make sure you have single point grounding as far as lightning as well as human safety is concerned. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Well, there's two different ways of doing this. One is the way it's normally done, the way you just described it, is typically what's done in industry. You have a large building that's built with steel beams, and most of the building is generally tied together by ground anyway, so you're forced to do it that way. Those are usually the most severe conditions for lightning damage because there's no common mode protection anymore. Now everything is completely different. In other words, because everything's galvanically tied together like a big string on one big ground plane, any pop-up in voltage anywhere is going to be across everything in the whole building. So if you don't have to do it that way, I would advise not to. In a residential area, your house is typically built of wood or sitting on concrete, a lot of dielectric in between. And when you have a wire entry from a different kind of service, like an amateur radio antenna, a TV antenna, something like that, if you just drive the ground rod right outside the house, directly into the ground, the charge is kept close to ground potential. Let me let it drop. And at that point in time, because the circuits are not all on the same grounds, what's happening is you have a bit of common mode rejection between the input that's coming in to the lightning that's in the closed loop getting shot into the ground outside the house about 1 foot away from the foundation. So having a little bit of common mode separation is actually a good thing. So I would say that in a residential location, I wouldn't want to tie all of the ground rods galvanically together. If you have to, you may have to, and then try to make that galvanic connection outside of the living area. In other words, you run it along the perimeter of the house. But if you don't don't have to do it, don't. Just make sure that your ground rod is as close to the plate of entry where your wire is going to come through, where your coax is going to come through, so that that circuit becomes localized to that one side of the house and you have a bit of common mode rejection between that circuit and your neutral. K2RIW, KS2QIQ.
Because that ground rod that's at the entrance where my coax cables comes into the house can easily have 1 ohm or a couple of ohms to the rest of earth. If my tower did get a direct strike, and now those leads, my coax cables going to that ground, are going to be lifted a few thousand volts above earth, so to speak. And that's now a differential between the rest of the wiring of the house for the service entrance. Those coaxial cables go to my ham radio equipment. So now the case of my ham radio equipment with those coax cables is a few thousand volts above ground during the lightning strike, and the primary transformer going into the rig, if it's being fed by 110 volts, is neutralized back to the ground of the service entrance. So across that trimmer, that 110-volt transformer of my rig, I've now got a few thousand volts across that transformer. You see what I'm saying here? There's a slight, this is a less than ideal condition. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet, you got it, Glenn.
KU2HUC with a comment.
Yeah, I hear you, Dick, but unfortunately it doesn't really work that way. In other words, that's not a very good analysis. Think of a lightning strike as a big battery floating around in the air. And what's happening is you've got a one-point connection. The only connection that you want to have to that battery is the rod that's in the ground. So if you've got a wire and that battery touches the plus or the minus side, winds up touching that rod, basically what happens is you've got common mode voltage that's just sitting there, but it's not differential back to the neutral. In other words, the only time that voltage becomes differential back to the neutral is when they're tied together. In other words, but they're completely different power circuits. In other words, your 220, your 115, all those voltages are all tied back down to the neutral and tied to the ground rod on the other side of the house. So basically, everything is floating along happy. So basically, if you have a lightning strike out there, which is a closed loop circuit, in other words, the lightning hits the rod goes down, as long as the wire stays intact in between your transceiver and that ground rod, you're still at potential earth. In other words, yes, the one side of the wire could go higher, the ground rod underneath the bottom might move up and down a little bit, but basically you're still at potential earth, because it's just like attaching the ground rod to a battery. The voltage really isn't moving up and down differentially with respect to the input service. KRIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Steve, recognize. I'm not sure everyone's going to agree with what you just said, Glenn. KD2HUC, K2R.
The method that you mentioned is definitely the way you have to go if you're in an industrial building and you have basically steel. In other words, if everything is already on a differential ground, that's where, in other words, everything's on that ground plane, you have to do it the way that you said. But when you're in a residential service, you're going to have a certain amount of common mode rejection. Let me pass it to the other person. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, you got it, Steve.
Yeah, Dick, I disagree with him wholeheartedly. Especially, what are the differences between a residential and an industrial service? First, the nobody feeds an industrial building from two blocks away. The transformer will bring primary right up onto the top property, and 13,000 volts is fed to a paramount transformer right outside the building. In the case of a residential service, the transformer feeding could be blocks and blocks away. Now, let me let it drop.
Steve, you've got to go a little bit lighter on your audio. Your audio is so heavy. Your bank of the repeater, your voice is coming out as square waves. We're having trouble understanding some of your words. Back to you, Steve, K2RIW.
Is this any better, Dick?
Yeah, that's a lot better. Go right ahead, Steve.
When lightning strikes, or even if a high voltage line comes down off the pole and hits the ground, for the moment in time that the lightning is touching or before the overcurrent on that high voltage line trips and de-energizes the line, the ground potential at that point comes up. they are very close to the actual feeder voltage. As you move away, it looks like a gradient chart. As you move away, the potential is different. Now, if you sink two rods in the ground at different distances from that point, there is going to be significant potential difference between those rods, based upon the ohmic value of the ground and a bunch of other variables that, you know, for this discussion are not necessary. Let me let it drop. So, in the event that you have something like this occur, and your neutral is grounded at another point that's not tied to your antenna, and then you even have to take it a step further, that neutral is also tied to a point that's grounded 3 or 4 blocks away, there is going to be a very significant potential difference between your antenna cabling and the neutral power wiring in your house. So, to mitigate that, the best mode of protection, and I employ this in a bunch of things, and I'll get to that in a second, is to employ a simple isolation transformer and redirect the neutral locally. Let me let it drop. By redirecting the neutral locally and tying it to the ground that you're using for your lightning protection, now everything that's supplied by that transformer, there is no potential difference between the antenna circuitry and the neutral. And it can't go back to a different point in ground because it's fully isolated. We employ this in substations, which is probably, you know, if you want to explore some lightning protection, take it out of the industrial environment, because the building steel actually helps to maintain an equipotential environment. All the electrical systems, derived transformers and such are required by code to be tied to building steel, so they stay at a relatively, you know, simple potential, an equipotential. And most of the industrial equipment is immune to that to begin with. Let me let it drop. In a substation environment where we have big feeders, stuff coming in at, you know, 69,000 volts, 138,000 volts, where, you know, grounding and lightning protection is critical, you start with by placing a substation ground grid, which is made up of 4 cable, making 6-foot squares, and every second square is a ground grid, is a ground rod, which is tied welded together. So that forces the ground at all points in the substation to remain equipotential, so that this way equipment doesn't find itself in a position where it's, you know, during the fault event, it's across ground, you know, different ground potentials, which results in fault current. And, you know, I mean, I guess we all know what happens when you have fault current flowing through your equipment. But that said, isolation is probably the most important thing, you know, relative to lightning protection. You know, ensuring that you don't have remote paths to ground of different potentials, because that's typically what will destroy your equipment. KD2, HUC, back to net.
Yeah, I've got a question for you now, Steve. Let me drop it. KC2 QIQ with a rebuttal. If I took everything you just told me now, Steve, to heart, I would have a good size isolation transformer feeding every piece of equipment in the shack, because the shack equipment is the one that's connected to these coaxial cables going out to the tower, and it's got a completely separate ground rod close to where those coax cables enter the house, and that could be quite a number of feet away from the main grounding of the service entrance to the house. So I've got a good size isolation transformer feeding all the equipment in the ham shack. And that isolation transformer has enough kilowatt volt amperes capability to feed all my ham equipment. The primary to secondary insulation is capable of 11,000 volts if a typical lightning bolt strikes my tower. And if I got 1 ohm on a good day, 1 ohm of grounding resistance on that grounding rod, my ham equipment is now going to be, during that lightning strike, 11,000 volts the width, so to speak. So now the secondary, the transformer, has got to take that. On top of that, if I'm running a kilowatt rig and I'm now feeding it on 220, do I have another isolation transformer feeding the 220 volts to my kilowatt rig. You can see some of the problems here, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RAW in the TechNet.
First, no, you do not need another transform. What you would do is you would have a simple transformer that would be a 240 with a center tap. The center tap, which is the neutral, gets re-derived and gets bonded to the equipment in the shack. Now, during a lightning strike, it is extraordinarily unlikely you will see the full 11,000 volts across the potential in ground, because it's going to go in multiple directions. You might see 2,000 volts, 3,000 volts, which is most good isolation transformers, especially those that are shielded, will be able to withstand that. And, you know, they're relatively inexpensive. However, you would not see the full voltage of the lightning strike across the equipment. But let's take it a step further, Dick. Let's say you did. Let's say you had an insulator on a table, right? And on top of that insulator, let's say that insulator is good for 30,000 volts. And on top of it, you put your battery, your ham radio, and your antenna. And you take a piece of equipment called a high pot, and you take that, the antenna, the radio chassis, and relative to ground, you energize it to 20,000 volts. The antenna, the battery, and the radio. All at 20,000 volts. However, the net potential between all those components is zero. What happens to the equipment? 82 HUC.
It sounds like it would be reasonably well protected because they're all at the same potential. So I think you're saying, Steve, you have one good size isolation transformer with 240 volt primary with its own separate ground back to the service entrance ground, if it's got a center tap, 240 does, and you've got a secondary winding of that isolation transformer where its center tap ground goes to the local grounding rod for the coax cables. I think you're telling me that's what you're using, and all of your ham equipment is on that isolation transformer. Is that the way you did it, Steve? Over to you, Steve.
That's the way it's being done, Dick. The transformer gets here next week. 82 HUC. Yes, that's what I'm saying, Dick. You need that isolation. You do not want your ham equipment tied to a power system that has a remote ground that could be well outside your property or your residence or numerous feet away where you can have ground potential difference. Because that's how you end up damaging the stuff. And I'll take it a step further. Let me let it drop. The polyphasor lightning suppression equipment. But that's some pretty dumb equipment. When I say dumb, I mean it really doesn't know the difference between the center conductor of your antenna going high or ground going high relative to the center conductor of your antenna. Meaning, if you have an event, a tree struck near your tower or something of that nature, and the ground comes up high relative to your center conductor of your cable, well, that polyphasor is going to conduct, and it's going to allow that current to shoot right down your antenna cable and come right into your shack. In which case, now, if it has some place to go, like out to a remote neutral through your radio equipment, then your radio equipment's going to go for a ride. If it has no place to go, if everything comes up in potential together, with that center conductor, then damage could be minimal. 82 HUC, back to you.
Eric recognized, and he's after Glenn. I still got another question for Steve. Steve, the isolation transformer that you ordered that's going to be delivered next week, you ordered how many volt amperes, how many watts capability, how big, how many pounds, how many dollars, what brand name? Since you've gone down this road, Steve, give us a little bit of a hint as to how big, how many watts, how many pounds, how many cubic feet, how many dollars. KD2HUC, K2LAW in the TechNet.
The one that I got is made by a company called Acme. Pretty much they're all the same. You can get them by Square D, you can get them by Acme, you can get them by a company called Solar Heavy Duty. I went with a 1 KVA. That's sufficient for the stuff that I have now. I can beef that up later on in life if I ever come into enough money to run a serious amplifier. I don't know that I would actually need it because most amplifiers are 220 volts and I think the front end is pretty much a transformer, a full isolation transformer, so if that's the case I shouldn't need to upgrade, but it's always possible. And it's simply 240 volt in, you know, it's a 240 by 480 in. You tap it for straight 240, and then it rederives, you know, 120, 240. And then I ground the transformer neutral to the ground point, you know, to my common ground point. And this way everything stays together. Everything in the shack, the neutrals are all together with the antenna. The only issue would be if my arms grew long enough where I could touch something inside the shack to something outside the shack during a lightning storm. KD2, HU6.
That 1 kilowatt isolation transformer, roughly how big, roughly how many dollars, Joe, go ahead. Boy, I'm terrible on names tonight. Steve, how many dollars and how big is it?
The one I got is epoxy encapsulated. It's actually a wall mount. I forget how heavy it is. It's like 40 pounds or something. It bolts right to the wall. No big deal. It was like, I don't know, 500 and change. You know, I'm protecting some big dollars in computer equipment and my radio, so to me it was worth it. And it's the direction I'm going to go. I recommend, you know, that other people do it. I've already done this in a substation environment. I've seen electronic equipment withstand, you know, some pretty serious high voltage feeder faults and not be damaged using this approach. So therefore, I'm going to employ it. KD2, HUC.
Yeah, just as I thought, it's a little bit pricey, but it does give you a lot of a peace of mind, and you can sleep a little better at night. But it's a bit of an investment for some of the people listening to us. KC2QIQ is going to be next, and after that's going to be Eric. So go ahead, Glenn, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, just a couple of rebuttals on this. I mean, certain things that you're saying are really, you know. Well, first of all, I've designed transformers for just about everybody for well over 30 years. And I don't know of any isolation transformer that was ever designed by any engineer at any time to withstand lightning potential difference from primary to secondary. Certainly to withstand isolation voltages between different things. Now, in an industrial situation, why is a isolation transformer so valuable? It's not because of lightning protection. It's because, as I mentioned before, everything is tied together on one major differential ground. It's tied all the way across the bottom. So if you've got multiple services, what's neutral? It doesn't. The building doesn't know whether it's the superstructure, the conduit. So the only way that you can prevent the circulation currents running all throughout that whole big differential ground is to use isolation transformers to break up the circuits into different loops. That's what the isolation transformers are for, not lightning protection. Let me let it drop. Second point, if you have a lightning strike, one of the things that I just keep on hearing, they get so confused. People think that when a lightning strike hits, everything all around the whole neighborhood is jumping up in voltage. The only place where the voltage is jumping up and down is where the lightning strike takes place. Then there's a differential voltage, and that voltage follows a current path. In order to have voltage, you have to have current through a resistance. So whatever the resistance is and the current in that area, it's like a battery. It's like a closed-loop circuit. So if you have on one side a lightning rod tied directly at the house where a wire is entering your house, and you terminate that loop right there at potential earth, and now why would there be a voltage difference between that ground rod and the ground rod that it's not connected to on the other side of the house? There's no currents between the two ground rods, so why would there be a voltage difference? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And the discussion I had earlier with Eric, he would take some exception to that one. In the case of your broadcast transmitters that run tens of kilowatts, Eric, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd have tens of kilowatts. Well, your primary power is more like hundreds of kilowatts. You'd have isolation transformers for that, which I suspect you might not. So I wonder how, at your broadcast station, they get around this problem. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, here again, that's another industrial area where everything's going to be on a differential ground. Everything's all tied together. It's different than in an industrial, isolated house. QIQ.
You've got it, Eric.
H-R-W-K, DJ. I kind of really disagree with what Boom is saying about there not being a difference in potential between the ground. But anyway, let me ask you a question. First of all, I want to kind of define a couple things. Are we talking about an antenna on a tower here at someone's house? Let's start with that. Okay, because the towers have a tendency to be grounded. If they fall properly. And how we hams do it versus what I do here. I take lightning strikes on a very regular basis, and, you know, it winds up at the input of transmitter. Like, it doesn't care about it whatsoever. So I do have a certain amount of protection for lightning that would hit the utility lines coming in, but I come in at 13.5, I then go to 440, and then from 440, on one transmitter, I go straight into the switching supply, but I pass through something called a satellite supply, which I really make spikes that appear to be 100,000 volts. Just talking about really big stuff. So let me hear it drop for a second. One of the things I haven't heard anybody talk about is the impedance of the ground system. And the fact that when you get a lightning strike, the ground's really going to absorb about 80 or 90% of the energy. And it's going to get saturated. Those electrons are going to be sitting there buzzing around. They're going to have to find some other place to go. The other thing I haven't heard anybody really mention, good procedures. I've heard people use single point of ground, but not in the sense of having, say, either in the shack or just outside the shack, a metal plate with everything that goes in and out passes on. Don't forget that power, being properly grounded, needs a certain amount of conduction. But power itself also presents itself as an inductor. You have other issues to deal with when it comes to this complex issue. And the other thing that I haven't heard anybody talk about is the frequency of a lightning strike, not how many times it gets hit, but the frequency of the energy of the lightning. You think of it as DC, but it ain't kids. KTRWK,
yeah, you've got a point there. It's one hell of a big transient. So I guarantee it's got frequency components that go close to a gigahertz, depending on how many dB down is your analysis. And in my case, I've got a grounding rod. I think it's about 3 feet or 2 feet away from the tower to the south with an 8-gauge piece of wire, another grounding rod at the base of the tower, a couple of feet to the north with an 8-gauge piece of wire. Those two pieces of wire and the grounding rod are below grade so that people don't trip over it when they're walking near the tower. And the tower being grounded and the cables coming down the tower, hardline cables, gives you a certain amount of protection as to what voltage is going to appear on the end of those coax cables as they enter the house. And then a local grounding rod as they enter the house is pretty good. But you and I gave an example to each other earlier, John, here we go, Eric, where two grounding rods on two different places on the property, when you use the right kind of equipment and you measure the numbers of ohms between those two grounding rods, let me drop.
By the way, the commercial gear that they measure the ground with, that.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. You just put an ohm meter across your grounding rods and you're now building up a galvanic action on the surface of the grounding rod. You get crazy readings. So if you do it at 100 kilohertz, you're really measuring the real resistance between the two grounding rods. And you did say it could easily be an ohm or multiple ohms, even with a moderately good conductive ground. And if I put 11,000 amperes from a lightning strike into grounding rod number one, and now that voltage, that current is flowing into Earth, spreading in all 360 degrees. And so with a given number of ohms between grounding rod number one and grounding rod number two, I believe I could get a substantial number of thousands of volts of difference between those two grounding rods because of the spreading resistance of Mother Earth and the number of feet between those two grounding rods. Do you see it that way, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the text net.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, you've got a couple things going for you. First of all, Kirchhoff laws states that any current fits on the current law. Any current has to equal the sum of what's being applied in any particular node. Think of antenna on a tower structure as the incoming point, and that the base of the tower is the node that's spread out. You're going to have current going at different levels in different directions depending upon the amount of resistance and how saturated the earth is, so to speak. I kind of lost it. Right. So, yeah, you're going to find difference in potential as you travel along, especially when you're talking about such high voltages and high currents. Although you may think that, like, 1-ohm ain't much resistance, but when you start, you know, zeros at the end of everything, it turns out to be a whole lot. I got to say this much, that the structure of the way it's really recommended, like around the tower, I've got 12 grounding wires, in essence, in a circle. A radial, whereas you've got one rod that's X feet away, and another rod that's X feet away, and a third rod X feet away. They don't recommend more than 75 feet strength going out. But one of the things that a lot of people don't do is they put the grounding cable in the ground, so it's got insulation on it. Everywhere you have bare copper that's buried in the ground, by the way, I'll give you a really good example. That thing got hit a couple times in the front. But the point is that energy that can't go in one direction, you're going to find the way to go in another direction. So that's why having a central point for it.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, unfortunately, Eric, we lost the last minute of that because of a timeout. You want to repeat the last minute, Eric? KE2EJ, KQIW.
Did I get to the point where I talked about the wires being bare?
Yes, you did tell us about the wires being bare. The energy's got to go somewhere. The wire being bare, building copper oxide when it's below grade, it's in an insulator. And you were starting to get up to 33rd Street, and you're starting to start saying that that was struck, and we didn't hear any of those details. Over to you, Eric. KQIW.
Yeah, what I did at the studio at 33rd Street was I put a tower up there for microwave dishes and TV antennas and I guess by normal standards, because the floors are more than 20 feet high, the top of the building is like tower with another 100 feet. So here you have a building that's kind of made out of, has a steel infrastructure, but it's all surrounded by cinder blocks. Basically, you're hoping that the building structure itself is grounded, but you know damn well that even when they bolt and weld those things together, you don't necessarily get a good electrical connection. Oxide. But anyway, what I did was I ran three double-aught cables from the roof, about a 700-foot length of line. They went down the side of the building into this huge ground system. It was actually part of the Long Island Railroad system and put a tunnel that they're building under. And we've had some good lightning strikes. And I put a series of coils on those lines coming down to measure the amount of juice. And I actually had the thing set up so I could read 5,000 amps, and it pinned it. So it was not an recording system. Kind of interesting, and actually walking on the street could feel the thing bump when it hit. So I thought it'd be an interesting story. KQIW.
Wow. Significant. Mother Nature, when she gets angry, boy, can she give us a bolt of energy, whether it be a gamma ray burst coming from space, or whether it be a lightning bolt of 11,000 or 50,000 amperes striking near your property. Now, you've got 12 separate grounding rods on that broadcast tower in plain view. And I think you said 12 grounding.
Hang on a second, I'll fix it.
Looks like I can get through this way. So you've got 12 grounding rods. You have three legs to that tower, 12 grounding rods. That implies you've got four grounding rods going to each leg. So that tower is extremely well grounded. And I think you've told me that on one of those strikes, you were in the transmitting room, and you heard a pretty loud snapping noise as if a high voltage discharge of some kind took place in the transmitting room, which was, let me pick a number, 30 feet away from the base of the tower. So I am guessing by a huge amount of current flowing down the tower. That huge amount of tower current flowing down the tower created one hell of a big electromagnetic pulse that in turn gave you a pretty loud voltage and discharge somewhere in the transmitting room. Is that roughly what happened, Eric? If I remember the story correctly, KE2EJ,
K2IW, K2EJ. No, that's not exactly it. Just the fact that the lightning hit the tower and the amount of light that was in the room and the actual percussion or the vacuum that was created made for very loud noises. It actually cracked one of the windows. But no, the stuff survived. The only one thing that I've had trouble with over the years is a differential audio line. And just how it happens that the EMP pulse not only clobbers the input of a JFET op-amp, and all the TV cameras, which are fed by unshielded Ethernet cables. That's smart enough to most of the stuff that we put in is all shielded cable, but the security people that put the cameras in weren't smart enough to actually wound up losing a bunch of switches along with it. Sorry, WK3J.
I thank you, Eric. I'm going to cut off the grounding discussion for tonight. We're going to move on. However, if you guys want to reestablish that... You guys want to reestablish that subject at a later time, later hour, we certainly can do it. But we should move on, because as you can tell, there's no exact solution to lightning protection. It's a little bit controversial. Each one of us has our own opinion as to the right way to do it, and there's no ideal solution. If lightning is going to directly strike you, and if it's a big enough of a bolt, even though you've done all the protection you can afford, occasionally you're still going to get a little bit of damage. It's not a showstopper. When you got people like Andy, WA2CDL, and with other people in this particular group that know how to fix anything, even if your front-end transistor gets blown out in your receiver because of a lightning strike, that's not the end of the world. 99% of the rig is still going to be operational and you can fix it. That's an opinion. I know that Joe has been waiting patiently and he's got his last question. WA2RYY, K2RYW. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this, Joe. Hope you're well grounded. You got it, Joe.
Okay, very good. Unfortunately, I didn't realize the tech that was going to be taking this amount of time on these different questions, so why don't you just table it till next week, okay? I'm kind of involved in something else at the moment. I'm listening, but I can't get involved in the radio transmitting right now. So you can table the question until next week. I'm sure I'll be back around.
Very fine, Joe. Don't forget that question. Hey, John, do we have any more technical questions that are going to break the bank and that are going to, you know, John and I make a joke about the fact when these letters and cards he gets give us a question that that stumps us, that in theory we give out a free pass to a very nice restaurant in Staten Island where you and your lady friend are allowed to go free of charge. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Well, one thing good, I don't have any grounding questions, that's for sure. Not that, but yeah, that's a great subject, and a lot of confusion there, and some good points were brought. Okay, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my first question, which was somebody listening to a discussion you had with someone else, but they had a question. I'll get back to you. WGB. All right, Dick. And Steve were having a question, a conversation, and there was another party involved too. I don't remember who that was, but it was aircraft with a speaker sort of mounted on top of the plane at the cockpit, a microphone, the tail, and the same thing in the other direction. And it was a question if the plane traveled fast enough, it could keep up faster than the molecule structure of air, that no sound would be reaching the cockpit microphone from the speaker on the tail. And he'd like you to explain that a
a little more in detail, if it's possible. I think it was covered quite well, but that's a question, so maybe you want to touch base. And it's an interesting subject anyway. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this was a set of technical discussions between me and Roy, AC2GS, and other people. I'm trying to remember who all was just involved in it. What it finally boiled down to is a theoretical airplane that tried to explain what happens at the speed of sound. In this theoretical airplane, the fuselage is 1,000 feet long, which is the reason why we chose 1,000 feet, or maybe we chose 1,100 feet. And you have a streamlined little bulb sticking off to one side of the nose of the airplane. And at the tail of the airplane, you now have another streamlined nose. And depending on which experiment you're running, the object at the nose is able to act like a loudspeaker that transmits a sound, and the object at the tail of the airplane, 1,000 feet downrange, is allowed to be a microphone. And then you can reverse it. The tail can be the loudspeaker, and the object up front is the microphone. And each one of these devices hanging off the side of the fuselage are in a streamlined package. They're not creating any disturbance of the air. Okay. And now, in one of those experiments, you're using a loudspeaker at the tail of the airplane. It's transmitting a signal toward the nose. Because sound moves at roughly 1,100 feet per second, when the airplane is not moving, 1 second later, because it's an 1,100 feet long airplane, whatever sound gets emitted, maybe it's pulses of sound at the tail, they get to the nose 1 second later. Now you start moving the airplane at speeds that approach the speed of sound. Let me drop them. And when you're flying at half the speed of sound, which is somewhere around 550 feet per second, the sound is still being emitted by the object at the tail. The sound is still traveling through the air at very close to 1,100 feet per second. But the air is moving 500 feet per second toward the tail because the airplane is moving. Relative to the airplane, it looks like the air is moving from nose to tail at 550 feet per second. The sound still gets through to the microphone in the nose, but it doesn't get there in 1 second anymore. It now gets there closer to 2 seconds because it's traveling through a hell of a lot more air. As the airplane approaches the speed of sound and gets to the speed of sound, the sound is still being emitted by the loudspeaker at the tail. The sound is still traveling in all directions, including toward the nose. It's traveling through the air at 1,100 feet per second, but the air is moving 1,100 feet per second toward the tail, because that's how fast the airplane is moving. In theory, the sound never gets there, particularly if the airplane is 1 foot per second faster than the speed of sound. The sound never gets there. So with the sound going forward, we have a somewhat understandable situation. Now, when you reverse the experiment, when the loudspeaker is in the nose and it's emitting a sound toward the tail, and when the airplane's not moving, it takes a second to get there, 1,100 feet. When the airplane is moving at the speed of sound, now you've got an interesting case. You're emitting a sound from the nose. The air that it gets emitted into, the sound is moving 1,100 feet per second. But the air itself is also moving 1,100 feet per second. As far as the microphone, let me drop it. As far as the microphone in the tail is concerned, air is moving toward it at 1,100 feet per second. The sound of that air is moving through that air at 1,100 feet per second. Therefore, as far as the microphone at the tail is concerned, that sound wave, that pulse, is coming to it at 2,200 feet per second, 1,100 feet per second of sound motion in air, air moving 1,100, you add the two together, it's moving 2,200 feet per second. The bottom line of that is the sound pulse gets from the nose to the tail, not in 1 second, but in half a second. So when you're emitting the sound at the nose, as you're at the speed of sound, the sound gets there in half the time. The sound is also louder because it has traveled through half the amount of air before it hits the microphone. And 6 dB per octave, the sound's going to be 6 dB louder if it's an isotropic transmitting microphone at the transmitting loudspeaker at the nose. So the one that's hardest to understand, well, both of them for some people are hard to understand. Should I go through any of that again, or back to you, John? You're the objective listener to this replay of that experiment that took place about a month ago. and maybe you want to add some words to it. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the second half.
KC2WGB, I'll add one more question that he proposed. He's inquiring whether or not the frequency will change from the transmitted portion at the cockpit to the tail at twice the speed. What happens to the frequency? That's about it, Dick. Back to you.
As I see it in this experiment, where both the transmitting device and the receiving device are both moving at the same speed, they have to hear the exact same tone. There's no Doppler shift in this case. If the loudspeaker at the nose is emitting a sound of 1,000 cycles per second, the sound is going to get there sooner because the air is moving at the same speed that the sound is moving through the air, so to speak, in that speed of sound situation. But I say that the microphone in the tail will hear 1,000 cycles per second. Here's another way of looking at it. If you think because of the velocities involved in Doppler shift, the sound is going to be either higher or lower. Most people would guess higher in frequency. And if you run the experiment for a solid hour, and the signal being picked up by the microphone in the tail is higher than 1,000 cycles, where are all those cycles piling up? You have a fixed distance between nose and tail. Microphone at the tail and loudspeaker at the nose are both moving at the exact same speed. So therefore, the number of cycles received in that microphone has to be 1 kc. If not, you're piling up a whole lot of cycles somewhere. Where are they piling up? But what would be different is that if the microphone is on the ground at a fixed velocity, so to speak, and now the airplane is moving toward that microphone or away from that microphone, now you're definitely going to see a Doppler shift, because the distance between the two is rapidly changing. Now you're not building up sound waves in between the two devices. You're changing distance, and there's a fixed number of cycles per foot in that air, if you know what I mean. One KC. Assume now that for rounding off numbers, let me drop. Assume if I round off the numbers that sound moves at 1,000 feet per second, and I'm now moving 1,000 feet per second, therefore there is, wait a minute, the sound is moving through the air at 1,000 feet per second, and the frequency is 1,000 cycles per second. You could say there's one cycle for every foot of air. So if you consider the air as a fixed medium that's not moving, then there's always one cycle per foot, so to speak. But when you're flying your airplane toward that loudspeaker, toward that microphone on the ground, you're piling up sound waves because you're changing the distance. You're going to hear a positive Doppler shift when the airplane is flying toward the fixed microphone on the ground. But when it's flying, when the microphone is on the airplane and the loudspeaker's on the airplane, I believe there's no Doppler shift. Because if not, if there's one cycle per second or one cycle per foot, 1,000 cycles per second, one cycle per foot of air, and there's a fixed distance between the transmitting device and receiving device, even though that air is moving, there's a change in the timing of how soon the pulse gets there. But when the pulse finally gets there, I say it's going to be at 1 kilohertz. When the emitting device and receiving device are both moving at the same speed, a fixed distance between the two. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. You're allowed to disagree with this one, and we can discuss it some more. It's not an easy one. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. I look at it as a way of having the aircraft fly across the piece of paper, the paper being the air. And if you look at the waveform being laid out in the amount of air, a difference. But amount of molecules in that air are not changing. It has the same density from the tail to the cockpit. So in that case, it's possible you're right, Dick.
Now, if your loudspeaker is in the nose emitting a signal and you're flying at a pretty high velocity, I will admit that those cycles being laid down into that non-moving air, those cycles are spread out. But because the microphone in the tail is moving at the exact same speed, it collects those cycles that are spread out it unspreads them, so to speak. So when there's a fixed distance between emitter and receiver, no matter how fast they're moving through that medium, as long as the signal gets there at all, the frequency has got to be right. Only when the loudspeaker is in the tail and the microphone is in the nose, now as you hit the speed of sound and above, as far as the microphone and the sound and the nose is concerned, the signal never gets there. And so what little signal gets there just before you hit the speed of sound is going to be quite a bit lower in volume, because it's been through a hell of a lot more air before it got there. From its point of view, it's traveled through a hell of a lot more than 1,100 feet of air. So therefore, it's by inverse square law, it's gotten weaker. But again, the frequency will be the same. There's a difference in cycles per foot of air, but that cancels when both emitter and receiver are moving. The frequency always comes out at 1 kc if it is, what's the word for it now? As long as the two things are moving, the frequency doesn't move. The Doppler is something that happens with relative velocity between emitter and receiver. In this case, the relative velocity is always zero between emitter and receiver. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I tend to agree, because if we have elongation of the wave on transmission, we have compression at the tail section, and I think they negate each other and bring it right back to zero. So, yeah, I agree.
How about the fact that you're launching it at 1,100 feet a second?
I think you've got a good question there, Eric, but complete the sentence. Is it the same K2LIW airplane, which is 1,100 feet long, and there's either a microphone or a loudspeaker in the nose, a microphone or loudspeaker at the tail, and the airplane is flying at some velocity? So you gave us a couple of words, but it was a very incomplete picture. So describe the picture that you're talking about right now, Eric. KE2EJ, KQIW. KQIW,
KQIW. Well, your vehicle, if your speaker is mounted on the vehicle, it's moving at 1,100 feet per second. You're now launching that wave into the medium at 1,100 feet per second. You have that velocity that you're starting with. Okay, so if you're thinking of directionality, that wave is coming out of the speaker at 1,100 feet per second. So, as we know, if we have different medium like water, ground travel slower through it. What is the relationship when you are moving past the molecules at 1,100 feet per second? Why would the sound not get there? If you're launching it at 1,100 feet per second. It's something I don't have very clear in my mind, but I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, one of the examples that's been used in the past, and by the way, sound travels through water faster than it travels through air, even though water's more dense. But the coupling of the molecules is different. The water molecules are moving at a faster rate than the air molecules, believe it or not. Air molecules in the room with you right now, Eric, are moving at 500 meters per second average speed. Yep. And I think the water molecules are moving at an average of 600 meters per second, 640, some number like that. Anyhow, one of the examples that's used is one of these water walking bugs, a bug that can walk across the surface of water. And each time his foot touches the water, he disturbs the water and makes a circle of wave that spreads out from that point. And now this bug is running across the water, and you're looking at the past events. His footsteps from a long time ago, those individual circles have spread out into a very large diameter by now, and the brand new ones he's launching as he's running across the water are much smaller. And when you look at that whole picture, you'll see small circles near the bug, and in the behind the bug, the circles get larger and larger, and those circles, depending on how fast he's running, those circles can be overlapping, but the circles are all off-center with each other. The smaller circles are toward the leading edge, so to speak, of the larger circles. So you get a bunch of circles that are non-congruent. Can you get that picture? KE2EJ, KQLIW.
Well, that helps, but now we're talking about, in terms of the bug, time versus the spreading
like that. If I've got a loudspeaker that's emitting a sound, it's isotropic. We'll assume a loudspeaker emitting sound in all directions. Each individual pulse of sound coming out of the loudspeaker becomes a circle that spreads out from that fixed point where it emitted the sound. But my loudspeaker is moving through the medium at the exact same time. Whenever that sound wave leaves the loudspeaker and hits the air, in that air, it's now always moving at 1,100 feet per second in that air. Therefore, the circles of the sound wave spreading out from the loudspeaker are more compressed in the forward direction, they're more spread out in the aft direction. But after they've been launched, once that sound wave has left the speaker and it joins the air, it doesn't know that that speaker was moving anymore. If from that point of origin, a circle is spreading out. Does that help a little bit, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, in essence, what you're saying is that as though the vehicle is not moving and it's spreading out lateral direction rather than in the direction of the microphone. In essence, really trying to say it's spreading out and staying in one place as the microphone comes right past it.
Yeah, you're getting closer. This situation, by the way, differs a whole lot with shooting a gun. If I'm shooting a gun, and if the muzzle velocity is 1,100 feet per second of my particular gun, but the gun is on this airplane hanging out the side, and the airplane is moving 1,100 feet per second, in that particular case, the velocity of the bullet with reference to ground is the 1,100 feet per second of movement of the gun added to the muzzle velocity of 1,100 feet per second. So now that particular projectile is moving 2,200 feet per second. Now that's a real projectile that you're putting energy into and you're launching it at some velocity. Sound wave in air is not like that. Once the sound wave has been issued from the loudspeaker, it hits the air starting at that point, and that air, from its point of view, is sitting still, and now you've disturbed that particular small group of molecules of that chunk of air, and now it's spreading out in a circle of equal velocity in all directions from that point. The bottom line is, if you look at all these past events of emitting the sound wave from this moving vehicle, you've got a bunch of circles, but the circles are packed tight together on the leading edge, and they're spread out on the far edge, if you know what I mean, because the newer sound waves you're issuing didn't get a chance to spread very far. They're smaller circles, but they're being emitted at a point further downrange, and therefore you get these lopsided circles. And at the speed of sound, all of those circles, all of those edges of the circle on the leading edge are all packed together with zero distance between them, but all the circles on the trailing edge in the back of the aircraft are all spread out at twice the distance between each cycle. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm beginning to see it. If we have the speaker pointed towards the nose, essentially the sound is going to wind up behind it.
If you're moving faster than the speed of sound, that's exactly right. If you're moving faster than the speed of sound, sound waves you're emitting toward the nose end up behind you. The sound waves never get to the nose. The nose doesn't hear the sound at all. And this is very different than what happens inside the Concorde. Inside the Concorde, you and I could be flying at 2,000 miles an hour, and the person inside the fuselage at the tail of the plane says, "Hello, Eric," and you at the cockpit of the airplane, inside the airplane, hear the guy say, "Hello, Eric." How are you, Eric? K2RIW.
That's funny. I'm actually in the car. I can see that. So, here's an interesting thing. So, as we hit the speed up and as we approach the speed of sound, amount of amplitude of the microphone head will be less and less and less.
You've got to give that man a cigar. As far as that sound wave is concerned, that sound wave that gets to the nose has been through a hell of a lot more air, and it's falling off inverse square law. Every time you double the distance, you get 6 dB weaker. So the sound you get as the microphone at the nose gets weaker and weaker.